I'm Dan Cassidy, and this is UBS's Top of the Morning. Unprecedented measures have been exercised by governments from around the world in an effort to combat and contain the spread of COVID-19. So how best to track the progress and effectiveness of these measures? My guest today will share with us some key indicators to track, which may shed some light as to when the pandemic will peak and conditions will normalize. Joining me here on the line for the conversation today is Head of Asset Allocation Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Jason Dreho. So Jason, good morning. Hope you're well, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, gang. I'm doing well. Hope you are, too.
Thank you. And Jason, I know throughout the course of our conversation, we will be referencing a publication which was authored by some of your global colleagues, the title of which, Global Financial Markets, How Should Investors Track the Virus? So before we get into some of the indicators that investors may want to consider tracking, can you first refresh us on the measures being taken by governments around the world in order to mitigate the impacts of COVID-19?
Well, they take a variety of forms, but all of it obviously to try and ensure kind of social distancing, kind of minimize, you know, human contact, the kind of large gathering groups, all of which is to try trying to slow the spread of the the COVID-19 virus. So the thing that, the most prominent ones are kind of closing schools. That's one aspect. Closing borders, so restricting travel across different countries, especially on flights, but just in general kind of cross-border crossing. And then within countries themselves, various kind of mobility restrictions. So that began with initially kind of maybe restricting kind of large crowds. So events that would have entailed, maybe more than 1,000 people, then 500, and then it kind of dropped down to 50. And in some cases, there was measures of crowds of anything larger than 10% or 10 people were prohibited, to the point where, just anecdotally, I've heard stories of certain New York City, this applies in most parts of the country, public basketball courts where there's nets, people were still gathering to play, pick up basketball, I think nets have been taken down to ensure that doesn't happen. And then the major thing that's obviously been the most impactful for the economy is to shut non-essential businesses, again, to prevent gatherings of crowds. But that's kind of certainly retail, bars, restaurants, most commercial activity. So there's a variety of measures that have been taken, which you can sort of say have an increasing level of impact on interaction of people, but also therefore on the impact on the economy.
So Jason, the big question or questions on the minds of investors is, when will some of these limitations that you just walked us through, when will they be lifted, and when will conditions, and that accounts for both social and economic, begin to normalize? So to that point, what kinds of indicators are you looking at, which are outlined in the publication, that could perhaps best gauge all of that?
Well, this is the most important question because, until we actually start to be able to lift some of these restrictions and resume a little bit of normality in economic activity, things will continue to kind of, on the economic front, get worse. So unlike where we normally would monitor traditional economic data to gauge what the outlook is, in this case, it's actually these other indicators for the virus that are the most important, certainly from kind of an investor perspective and obviously in and of itself for what it means for the virus. So the most prominent one that people talk about is the number of confirmed cases, absolute, but also in terms of perhaps percentage of population. Those are, kind of give some context because, different countries at different sizes, it will vary just as a result of the number of cases they have. But, it's important to kind of adjust that relative, to the, the population, so it's more on a per capita basis. And actually looking, at the number of deaths, because that's a pretty, kind of cut and dry measure, as opposed to, cases, can be a little bit, not always kind of capture everything. Looking at things like the positive or negative test ratio. So when you do the number of tests, how many actually people are coming up as positive versus negative. And then, kind of hospitalizations, like how many people are actually going into, requiring hospital care, but then also thinking about it in terms of the percentage of people or the percentage of hospital facilities, the number of beds, the ICU units, ventilators actually being kind of required, because again, countries also vary in terms of the hospitalizations and also their hospital facilities, So, a number could be large in one country, but if they have a minimal or large number of hospital facilities, that's more tolerable as opposed to if they have a kind of a smaller number of facilities. So these are a variety of measures that we kind of look at in aggregate.
Within the publication, it's talked about the combination of the indicators that you just shared with us, why the combination of them matters in terms of a clear interpretation of the data. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, the reason why is that there's no one kind of perfect measure. So, people might think, the confirmed cases could actually be, a good gauge. It certainly gets probably the most attention. The problem is that it's, the number of cases confirmed depends heavily on your ability to actually conduct testing. And so if you do more testing, your chances are you're going to find, more cases. It also depends on whether you're testing people only, who actually express symptoms or those who don't, or who are kind of, asymptomatic. So depending on how widely the number of tests are being done, that's going to affect the number of your confirmed cases. So in and of itself, it's an important data point, but it's really far from kind of informative overall. Kind of related to that, thinking about the positive versus negative test ratio, if you have a high number of tests that are coming out positive, or if the ratio is kind of rising alongside with increasing testing capacity, it's actually suggesting that the number of undetected cases is quite high. So what we've seen in some countries is that as they've taken, testing more people, the percentage that are actually testing positive is declining. But in the case of, say, like New York State or New Jersey, where there's, a high number of cases overall, until recently, so somewhere around the range of 50% of all tests being conducted were coming up positive. So really it was telling you that the tests are being restricted, the most part, to people who have symptoms or are already ill, as opposed to doing a broader kind of indication of the population. So as more tests are done, you'll start testing more people who don't have the illness, and that's where the positive-negative ratio will come down. And in some way, long-term, that's kind of a key part of the solution, because we really want to be able to test as many people as possible, and what you should see then is roughly a few positives coming up, which is good. Same thing with kind of hospitalizations. That's kind of an actual number of really people who are truly kind of getting sick. If that starts to kind of flatline or decline, it could indicate that we're just doing a better job of testing, or the number of people that are being tested, fewer becoming positive. So that's kind of an important data point. But again, it's only kind of part of the story. So really, when we look at all these different measures, if we see a falling number of new cases, a falling sort of positive negative test ratio, falling hospitalizations, collectively that's a much more kind of robust measure that we're kind of effectively bending the curve on how that's taking place. And that's when we look at a place like Italy, where when across all those measures, they're all sort of trending in the right direction, which is why I think the view, at least for a country like Italy, has turned a little bit more positive over the past 4 or 5 days, because a consistent signal coming from all these measures is showing some improvement. I think in the U.S., depending on where you are in the country, by different states, some are improving, others aren't. So that's why there's still a little bit of a little more uncertainty of the progress being made here, which is not kind of understandable, because we were always about 10 days to 2 weeks behind to Europe in terms of the escalation of cases. So it still may take until next week before we start to see a more consistent pattern of these data points improving, certainly in some of the hot spots that begin early on, such as New York City and the surrounding areas.
So when you account for all of those indicators and the data that we have access to, the data that we have in front of us, and the estimates for that matter, what does it all suggest as to when the pandemic peak will occur, not only here in the U.S., but also Europe?
In Europe, it looks like they're already kind of nearing that peak. So around now or within the next few days, it's likely to peak. Now, it doesn't mean it will come down quickly, but as the rate of growth really kind of starts to stabilize, then as people get healthier, as these kind of restrictive measures we discussed earlier continue to stay in place, then you can start to see a more rapid decline on the number of cases. In the same way, there's a kind of almost an exponential growth in the number of cases. When it starts to accelerate, you could start to get sort of a similar kind of exponential decline in the number of cases in Europe as we move later into the month or into May. For the U.S., we're looking, again, maybe a little bit later than that, more like kind of mid-April, so perhaps by next week. Again, a little bit of variation, across the country, because some areas, were inundated earlier and then took the stronger measures sooner. Seattle and the surrounding areas was one of the areas where there was a first hotspot, and they took significant measures on sort of restrictions. So already last week, they started to see some signs of the number of cases curtailing. I think you could see some signs also maybe in New York City, perhaps by the weekend, a bit of a kind of peaking there. But other parts of the country we're seeing now kind of a more rapid acceleration. So in aggregate, we're probably another week or two away in the U.S., but it could also be the case that there's a bit of a kind of two peaks, one that's more on the coast, whether it's New York or some of the coastal areas, or same thing on the West Coast, whereas parts of the country that are in the middle part that were slower to get it, maybe a little bit slower to implement more restrictive measures, the peaks there could actually occur a little bit later, perhaps later into April or earlier into May. Hopefully that's not the case, but that's some of the data suggests that might be that there might be sort of two kind of peaks depending on where we are in the country.
And Jason, with all of that in mind, at this point, would it be appropriate to assign a timeline as to when we can expect more normal conditions and activities to resume?
Our kind of central kind of assumption right now is that the most severe restrictions could start to be lifted by potentially by May. Certainly in Europe, I think that's kind of looking likely. Just in the past 48 hours, Austria and Denmark both announced some plans to slowly start to allow some businesses to reopen, whether it's retail, bars, restaurants, some possibility that schools could resume within about a week or two. So you're kind of gradually sort of introducing it. I think for the U.S., given that we will not see the peak perhaps for another week or so, maybe later elsewhere, and then you have to see an actual clear deceleration. I think we're well into May before we start to see, on a broad base, some of the measures lifted. So I would think perhaps by end of May, early June, that at that point in time, sort of a majority of businesses, not all of them, can start to be kind of opening up again, but in various capacities. So, for example, in restaurants and bars, one of the initial measures was they could stay open, but they would have to operate at around a 50% capacity. So something similar might be the case when they reopen, that they can reopen, but initially they have to cut their capacity by half. There could also be a staggered opening up of different businesses. Those that are deemed various levels of essential activity are allowed to return to work. Those businesses or activities that can be done more remotely, such as in the case of for us for financial services, there might be kind of a slower move to allow those back. All of the idea that you try to maintain some degree of social mobility, put maybe less stress on business capacity, various transportation systems. But I think by late May, early June, I think in the U.S., given sort of some of the current trends we're seeing, I think that's realistic to expect that we'll have at least a majority of businesses start to reopen at that time frame, some a little bit earlier, some a little bit later.
Well, Jason Trejo, thank you for your time this morning. Very insightful conversation, and for spending some time sharing with us the indicators that CIO is monitoring and what perhaps they suggest as to when the pandemic peak will occur, both here in the U.S. as well as over in Europe, and further when we can expect to see some conditions and activities resume back to normal. So it was a terrific piece put out by your global colleagues. Again, that's Global Financial Markets, How Should Investors Track the Virus, which is up now on UBS Online Services. And again, we've been joined this morning by Head of Asset Allocation Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Jason Trejo. So Jason, thanks again, and we will speak again soon.
You're welcome, and stay safe.
Thank you, Jason. You as well. If you are interested in receiving a copy of the publication that Jason cited throughout the course of our conversation this morning, again, that is Global Financial Markets, How Should Investors Track the Virus? Just reach out to your financial advisor, and your financial advisor can provide you with a copy of the report directly. Top of the Morning, we'll be back again for you tomorrow morning. Have a great day, everyone.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways countries and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.